with the cost of living crisis, our first time callers more are calling us about money worries. So a big thing for us is if we can get the rates down to the lowest ever, let's really work on that. What is really going to drive that?
Welcome to Communicating Purpose. I'm John Higginson, founder of purpose-led communications agency Higginson Strategy, and I believe that the best way to get a message across clearly is by talking about something you honestly and passionately believe in. By doing so, you bring people with you. Your passion becomes theirs, and I call this the power of purpose. Today, I'm joined by Sonia Trivedi, Executive Director of External Engagement for the Samaritans. As I'm sure many listeners are aware, the Samaritans is a unique charity dedicated to reducing feelings of isolation and disconnection that can lead to suicide. In prisons, schools, hospitals, and on the rail network, the Samaritans' 23,000 volunteers are working with people who are going through a difficult time and training others to do the same. Sonia has dedicated the last two decades of her life to the UK's voluntary sector, working for international organisations such as British Red Cross and UNICEF, and for domestic causes including HIV, sexual health and domestic violence. She now leverages that experience in leading the Samaritans' external communications advocacy efforts and income generation. Sonia, it's a pleasure to have you on the show today. Tell us a bit more about your own background and your journey to where you are today.
Thanks, John. Lovely to be with you. So, a bit about me. I was born in England, but I've got quite an interesting heritage. My dad is of Indian heritage, but born in Kenya, and my mum is Guyanese. I grew up in Luton, quite a multiracial town, and I think that's really influenced where I am today. One of the things about me is I have fantastic aunties and uncles who I used to see a lot when I was growing up, and you know, they were activists. They, you know, supported the likes of Greenpeace and CND. And my uncle worked at Save the Children, Oxfam. So that's really influenced me, my journey. So did my A-levels and didn't do very well, actually. So I ended up doing, went through clearing. And luckily, I got an environmental sciences course. And one of the things within that course is we learned about NGOs. And I think hearing about them in that course and from my aunties and uncle really gave that keen interest in the voluntary sector. So like most people, I had loads of debts when I left university. So I fell into IT recruitment. And this was before Y2K. So actually, in my early 20s, I was earning quite a bit of money. But that is not what I wanted to do. I didn't want to get a mortgage then. So I thought, right, okay, I'm going to volunteer. So I went for this job at Help the Aged, and I didn't get it. But the recruiter said to me, he said, Sonia, why don't you come and volunteer for me? So I did that for a while. And then this job came up at Red Cross. And apparently I was in the question mark pole, but the guy at British Red Cross knew the guy from Help the Aged and said, oh, do you know Sonia? You know, should I be recruiting her? And he gave me a good reference. So that started my journey. And he actually went on to be my mentor, that guy. So I consider him my guardian angel in my career. I then stayed in international development for quite a few years, worked at Every Child as well. And then my biggest time in the voluntary sector was with Terence Higgin Trust, the HIV and sexual health charity. Absolutely brilliant, brilliant organisation. I was there for 9 years, and then I did interim and consultancy and decided that I wanted to go back permanent. And I am very, very privileged that I've landed now at Samaritans, and I've been here for 5 years.
Wonderful. Now, I'm just going to explain to some of our listeners who might not be quite as old as us what Y2K is, because you just mentioned that. It stands for year 2000. And for those of us that were around in the 1990s, there was this fear that all the computers had been set so that they'd just break down once they reset to the year 2000, like it was on a ticker. And people feared that the cash machines would all start dispensing everyone's money, and everyone's money would go and everyone's data would be lost. And it probably seems quite strange to think about that now, as if that could have never happened. But at the time, a whole industry was created. So all these IT people would go into businesses and say, no, I'm going to fix your computer so it doesn't break in the year 2000 when we hit that. But people actually thought there'd be complete chaos and that people would be running around the streets and that we'd be in that sense. And it goes to show that sometimes we can all be a bit paranoid. In the end, we hit year 2000 and absolutely nothing happened whatsoever. And this whole multi-billion pound industry that had been built around fixing the computers turned out to be absolute rubbish. No one was fixing any computers whatsoever. None of the computers were doing anything. So it's a really good one to look at. I always look back at that and think, wow, you've sometimes got to look at the way humans act in mass, and it can sometimes feel a bit silly, to say the least. But that's what we did. It was called the Millennium Bug, that everyone thought that they were going to was going to eat everyone's data. So just bringing you back on that bit.
In my early 20s.
There you go. Well done. Well done. Just tell us a bit about what your primary roles and responsibilities are as executive director now of external engagement at the Samaritans.
Yeah, thank you. Well, you did a great introduction to Samaritans. So just to touch on that again, we are the leading suicide prevention charity across the UK and Ireland. And, you know, we are best known for our listening service. So we are there on the phone, but we also do, as you said, email. We actually have a correspondence branch. People can actually write to us and get responses. And we have over 201 branches, 23,000 incredible volunteers. And the key thing about our service is it's free, it's confidential, and it's non-judgmental. And we take a call for help every 10 seconds. So within that, my role is to look after our fundraising department. So we have to raise over £20,000 a year to keep our service running and to ensure that it does remain free, because we want anyone who's faced an emotional crisis to be able to reach out to us. Within that team, I am also responsible for our work with the Rail Network, so Network Rail. That is a multifaceted partnership. So we have trained over 30,000 people across the rail environment to spot the signs of people struggling to cope and in suicide prevention. We work at a local level, so with train operating companies. And a big part of our work with them is our awareness raising campaigns. So the one that people are probably most familiar with, because it's been running for a number of years now, is Small Talk Saves Lives. So that is about encouraging the general public to have the confidence, if they spot someone and they, you know, something doesn't look quite right, if it's right and it's safe to do so, you know, maybe just approach them and, you know, make a bit of small talk, you know, oh, do you know where I can get a coffee around here, something like that. So it could potentially break their feelings. You know, they might be in quite a dark place. They might be having suicidal feelings, to break their thoughts. So that's a really important campaign for us. And then I look after external communications. That's all the things you would expect. So our brands, you know, we're one of the most trusted charity brands in the UK, but we're not complacent about that. We always have to think very carefully about our brand and how we're talking to our audiences. We've got print and design, web, social media, press and PR within that area. And then the other area that I look after is policy and influencing. So that's really about how we affect policy. So one of the big things that we have been campaigning for a number of years to ensure that there is a suicide prevention strategy. And that was agreed last year. It was cross-party. That was hugely important. Our next steps on that are to make sure it's fully funded and has resources and backing behind it. And then also within that space, it's around influencing practice as well. So a service that some of your listeners may or may not know about is our media advisory service. So we have had media guidelines for 30 years now, and we've been offering a media advisory service for over 10 years. And that is all about responsible reporting around suicide. So how you report is really, really important, because we need to make sure that we're not talking about method or location or anything like that. So that's really key. So that's my remit. And hopefully, John, in your world as a journalist, you would have come across a media advisory service.
I did. Yeah, absolutely. And I think at one stage, because I didn't really understand the importance of that. And as a journalist, I went through the different ranks of being a journalist. So I was on a local paper before being on a national paper, and actually far more on local papers. You're covering stories of, you know, birth, marriages and deaths are the big moments of people's lives. And you do cover a lot of stories of deaths, and some of those deaths are suicide. And as a young reporter, you don't actually cover that in the NCTJ back then when I did it, certainly didn't cover that aspect of things. So that when I was working on a local paper, I didn't quite understand how important it was to avoid talking about the methods and how you get in some areas and in some communities, people see it and they think, oh, okay, it's now okay for me to do it, because that's what human nature is. We tend to copy each other a bit. And there's areas of the UK, I remember, I'm not even going to mention, but where you've suddenly had a large number, as often, of teenagers, one after the other, committing suicide. And I'm being really careful with my words now. Yeah. But I did, as soon as we covered as a newspaper the wrong way for the 15-odd years after that, I made sure I was very careful with the way that we were reporting suicide and making sure that went all the way up to editorial level. And clearly, even at editorial level, they didn't know, because as a reporter, you're not the last line before the copy goes out into the paper. You've got a news editor above you. You've got an editor above you. So 20-odd years ago, it wasn't as well known, but I think good work's taken place. And when you read about suicides, you often don't see that. And if you're wondering why you don't see that, that's why. That's the reason. People copy each other. And they think it's okay. And isn't it, this podcast is called Communicating Purpose. And what better way to communicate purpose than what you just mentioned there? You could just, you know, who'd have thought that you can ask someone where you can find a coffee and that could potentially save their life. So it really goes to show. You talked there about your background, which is very diverse. You're British, but you've got parentage of Kenyan Indian as well as
Guyanese.
So you've got a lot of diversity in your own ethnic mix there. But I think that's something that you're quite passionate about. Just tell me about how you bring that to life in your work.
Yeah, I am hugely passionate about this because, you know, we all need to feel seen. And, you know, that doesn't always happen. And I think that making people feel seen and included is hugely important in order for people to be their best selves. At Samaritans, you know, I've done a lot of work around this and I talk about being the golden thread. It needs to run through absolutely everything you're doing. So, you know, it can start from how you're communicating to the outside world. You know, the people that you want to come and join your organization, to work at your organization. So if you think about your recruitment practices and, you know, where are you advertising and how are you advertising, what are the things that you're saying, to the moment someone steps through the doors, how do they feel included? You know, talking to them about, you know, reasonable adjustments, finding out a bit about them so you can give them the best opportunities to thrive. You know, and for us at Samaritans, we know that there are marginalised communities who are disproportionately affected by suicide. So we need to think about that all the time in terms of how we deliver. So a big thing for us always is thinking about personal experience, what we call lived experience, that might feel quite jargony, and telling those stories so that people can feel seen when we are communicating, so that anybody knows that if they are facing emotional crisis, we might be the type of organisation that they can contact. So we have to be really purposeful in terms of the channels we use, the messaging we use, how we tell that story, making sure that we're testing and we're getting it right. You know, you were talking just then about being really careful with your wording. So it's things like that, things that aren't going to trigger people, so we can be as open as possible. And that runs right across through, you know, our staff, our volunteers, how they feel about their experience of being here. Because actually, if we have unhappy people within our organisation, people are going to feel that on the outside. You know, and they're going to tell their stories about how they feel. So it's important that people feel seen and they're having a good experience. And then how the outside world sees us as well is really important, so that they feel, actually, Samaritans is an organisation for me. They feel like an organisation for me, and I can reach out to them when I'm facing emotional crisis. So it's hard, John, because, you know, you have to think about it all the time. And I think that for me, one of the things is learning, and it's trying to create that culture of, you know, again, sorry to use jargon, psychological safety, so that people can speak up, you know. So my teams tell me things like, Sonia, can you make sure that when we have our conference, you know, our staff team meeting, we put our pronouns on our badges? You know, for some people that is hugely important. You know, can you make sure you talk about gender neutral toilets? Can you talk about reasonable adjustments, where the hearing loop is? You know, all of these things, you know, but I'm continually evolving, you know, how I approach this and learning from other people. But it's giving people the space to tell you what they need, so again, they can feel seen.
Well, look, you've done a lot of work over the last couple of decades in causes that challenge stigma and promote inclusion. And I think you spoke at the top of this conversation about some of those early influences on you. Are there any other things that drive your passion for it?
One of the things is, I remember when I was at school, we did a whole term, I think it was, on stigma and discrimination. And we read To Kill a Mockingbird. So any of your listeners who don't know that, I'm sorry that you don't know that. And please go and read it, because it's absolutely a really important book of our times. And it's still very relevant, the story of stigma in there. And, you know, I remember at the time feeling really a deep sense of urgency that no one should have to be treated, you know, in this way. And there are lots of things about my journey, you know, that have influenced this space. You know, my mum, when there was a period of time she talks about when she was younger and her brother and my grandma were living, you know, in poverty, and my grandma would go out and have to find food and come back with a biscuit and break it in two, and half for my mum and half for her brother, and she would go without. And stories like that, I think, that drive me to make change. And then I talked about Terence Higgins Trust, you know, being somewhere like there, amazing, amazing people, full of people that are driving change. But can you imagine any other condition where you might not tell people that you have something, you know, that you have HIV? And there are still people today that might feel uncomfortable talking about their HIV status. I mean, I still find that really, really shocking that you couldn't reach out to your family and friends. And I've heard stories from people living with HIV who have had really bad experiences when they've told their family or friends. Not everyone, and things are changing, and organisations like Terence Higgins Trust have done a huge amount to break the stigma. But that has really, really driven me. And, you know, I was fortunate to be on a course in recent years, and one of the parts of it was around finding your personal purpose. And actually in that, I really thought about myself and what I'm all about, and I've realized that my personal purpose is around opening doors for people, you know, making sure they are given that opportunity to thrive. And, you know, I think that working at someone like Samaritans or Terence Higgins Trust, you can do work at a bigger picture level, but also you can do things personally. So for me, it's things like working with my team, it's mentoring people, you know, I try and do that a lot, volunteer, you know, and it's allowing people to find their voice. And sometimes if they don't feel like they're on a journey finding their voice, it's supporting and advocating for those people in that journey. So yeah, there's probably lots more that I can say around that, but definitely some specifics that have really driven me around finding my personal purpose.
Great. And if you haven't listened to the previous episode from Matt Mahmood Ogston, I'd recommend, founder and CEO of the Naz and Matt Foundation, I'd recommend listening to that, because he's also doing a huge amount of work around stigma, particularly in conservative communities, around being gay. Now, The new Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, has assembled the cabinet with the strongest charity sector background in history. How do you think this influx of people with charity sector expertise will influence government policy going forward?
Well, I think that, you know, I've talked about diversity. Diversity of thought is hugely important. So people having voluntary sector experience as well as commercial, public sector experience, that is really, really good to ensure that there is greater understanding, you know, and the voluntary sector and the way it operates is, you know, very different to the commercial sector. So having that expertise in the room, I think, is hugely important. The other thing I would say is that they have already wanted to engage. So we know that in the lead up. But we also know that the minister who has was responsible for suicide did get on the phone to our CEO within her first day. You know, that's really important in terms of engagement. We want those open conversations. And I'm sure we're not the only ones. I'm sure they called a lot of people. And that's really important in terms of that open dialogue. So that feels really positive to me. But I think a really important thing for us is that suicide prevention is everyone's business. So we are always about cross-party support. So, you know, if we think about, we'll be looking for the all-party parliamentary group on suicide prevention to come together to convene again. You know, we need that to be cross-party. You know, and if we think about colleagues, you know, Lib Dems, you know, lots of people elected, you know, it's important that we are speaking to all parties. So that's really important for us in terms of driving suicide prevention. And we want to get to the lowest rates possible. And so that's going to require open dialogue. So I do feel hopeful. I think that's really great, that expertise, but there's still like lots of tough conversations to have going forward, aren't there?
There are. And where are we currently? Because I know that during lockdown, a lot of people it was very hard for a lot of people. In terms of suicides in the UK, is it going up or down, or how's it looking?
Well, suicide rates were steady during lockdown, despite some of the coverage, actually. But early surveillance for the last year is telling us, so it takes quite a while for the actual data to be published, but early surveillance is telling us that suicide rates in the last year have gone up. And we know that after the last recession, that suicide rates did go up. So that is something for us to really think about. We know that with the cost of living crisis, our first time callers more are calling us about money worries, and that continues to be an issue as why people call us. So a big thing for us is that really, if you look at data over the last few decades, rates haven't really come down very much. So, you know, they've sort of stayed static. So a big thing is, firstly, that suicide prevention strategy and all those measures that are in there, making sure the government is really thinking about ensuring that that is well-resourced and it gets delivered. But then if we can get the rates down to the lowest ever, let's really work on that. What is really going to drive that?
Good. Well, lots of work to do there with a new government coming in. Sounds like there's lots of work to do cross-party as well with those big influx of new MPs. Lots of them, I'm sure, need lots of education on the issue, because it's something that, as you say, people don't like to talk about. And as a result, people don't know enough about it and don't know how to help. What's been one of your biggest communications wins in your career?
Oh, gosh, I think that I think it's the London Marathon Charity of the Year. So at Samaritans, you know, like with many charities, we don't have big budgets. So we have to really think carefully about how we're using our spends and how we're telling people that we're here. So with London Marathon, we're able to, what you get in that Charity of the Year partnership, you get lots of extra places. So we had a team of over 300 runners, which was incredible to see a sea of green, Samaritans, our brand out there. So they raised so much money. They raised over £1 million, which was absolutely incredible for us as an organisation. But a big thing for us is our campaign, which we pitched and we executed throughout, was Believe in Tomorrow. And a big thing for us is stories of hope. So letting people know that if they are in a difficult place emotionally, they're struggling to cope, there is a pace to turn, but there is hope. And we want them to know that there is a tomorrow. And so we did lots of things around this in terms of bringing it to life. So for the first time, the London Marathon, across the race course, there are emotional support hubs. So we got volunteers from all across the UK and Ireland to come and man those emotional support hubs. So if anyone was struggling, and we did have people come to us at that time, you know, London Marathon, if anyone hasn't been to it, you know, go. It's one of the most joyful days in London to see human emotion. It's just at its best. It's absolutely fabulous. But, you know, we know that in a crowd, we can feel lonely and isolated. We may be going through things. So to have those hubs there was important. One of the things that London Marathon does brilliantly as well is they have tail walkers. So people at the end, people who are there, you know, at the end of the course, who are struggling, they might have had an injury once they've started, or it's being with them, saying to them, you know, you've got this, I'm here for you, let's talk. So we joined that team. We had Samaritans volunteers as part of that. But then the big thing for me is the storytelling. So we had over 30 storytellers as part of it. We got loads and loads of coverage. Our big one was Dave, the running phone. So for anybody who watches the marathon, you probably have seen him. He's run for the last 25 years for Samaritans. And his story is incredible. In the 90s, he was struggling. He contacted Samaritans. He says, Samaritan saved my life. He went on to become a listening volunteer himself. He then started running for Samaritans, has raised thousands of pounds for us, but also being a spokesperson and, you know, being that really strong ambassador for us. And very, very sadly, he lost his brother to suicide last year. Mm. And, you know, that was really, really tough for him and his family. And so when we got London Marathon Charity here, we have such a good relationship with him. We said, will you be our mascot? Will you be our cheerleader and the head of the, you know, running squad? And so he took that on board. He took that baton and that mantle and he ran with his daughter. And there was quite a lot of press coverage in the build up and on the day, actually, about him and his story. And like, he's done 25 years and I couldn't believe it. He's now signed up to do 2025. I just can't believe it. But the big thing about that, John, and why is a success, is we don't want anyone to be alone. We don't want anyone to face emotional crisis alone. So those messages of hope, but people knowing that we are there, that 116, 123, anyone can call. And we will be there for them 24/7. That is the biggest thing. And to me, that is the biggest success of that, is making sure that more people knew about us and they had a place to turn, or that they thought about their friends and family and they thought, actually, there might be someone in my friend and family who are struggling. I'm going to reach out to them. So that is really important, getting that message out there.
Yeah. That's a great story of success there. Just, can you tell us about a time where it's not gone the way you wanted in engagement or communications?
I think one of the things for me is we're all about listening to Samaritans, and listening is hugely important. And when I first joined Samaritans, I actually hadn't ever worked for an organisation that was a federated organisation. So we have lots of branches that have their own ways of working. We have an operating agreement with all those branches. There's over 200 of them. I've never worked with so many volunteers, 23,000 volunteers. And we all know that when we develop campaigns, it is about taking people on a journey. So, of course, you have to engage the people that use your services, people with personal experience, lived experience. You have to engage your supporters. But for Samaritans, we also need to engage our amazing volunteers, our 23,000 volunteers. And I think for me, my biggest lesson was at the beginning, there were certain things that didn't land so well because I didn't know how to navigate that. I didn't understand the importance of engaging with those 23,000 people, and I didn't know how to navigate that. And I think that is why that I talked about that listening at the beginning there. That listening is hugely important. If you think about when you go into a new setting and a new environment, a new job, where, you know, quickly want to show it, you know, say, oh, you know, this is what I'm capable of, this is what I can do. But actually the power of listening is really important because it helps you to understand the circumstances and how, I suppose, the rules of engagement. And so that is one of my really big lessons, and perhaps one of the things that didn't go so well for me when I first joined Samaritans. I didn't do that good listening. I didn't do the thing that Samaritans is good at. I didn't do that good listening at the beginning and work out how to engage all of our wonderful people that are part of our organisation.
Well, Sonia, it sounds like you've got there now. Just finally, anyone listening to this, what can they do to get involved, or maybe tell us that number again for listeners?
Yeah, so I think that, you know, anyone that wants to get involved, you know, do take a look at our website. You know, actually speak to someone you know who may be a listening volunteer. I think, John, you said that someone in your family is a listening volunteer. You know, as soon as you start speaking about Samaritans, someone will open up about knowing someone or someone who's called. So speak to those people. Look at our website. I think that if you can volunteer, that's a big challenge for us, you know, making sure that we've got more flexible volunteering. It's a big commitment, but we're thinking about that all the time, how we can make it flexible for people. So look at that. Campaigning, you know, I've talked about how we influence government. We've got a campaign, Saving Lives Can't Wait. We will definitely be doing lots on that in the coming months. So please sign up to be a campaigner. But of course, as I said, we face financial challenges. So, you know, think about if you can, you know, if you want to do your big challenge, if you want to run the marathon, you know, think about that at your workplace. Can you do something for work colleagues? But my final message to all of you is you may know someone who is struggling. You yourself may be struggling. I would encourage you, please reach out to that person. Ask them, how are you? How are you really? Ask yourself if you are struggling, and yourself, call Samaritans, or tell your friends or family, whoever it is, to call Samaritans, because we are there 24/7, and that number is 116123. We've got amazing volunteers ready to take your call.
Sonia Trividi, Executive Director of External Engagement at the Samaritans. You've been speaking to me, John Higginson, on Communicating Purpose, produced this week by Catherine Kitchen. If you'd like to know more about how Higginson Strategy supports purpose-led organisations, please visit higginsonstrategy.com.